Episode 7 of the Chattering Classes, and we're talking with Emily Squires, who's taken us through 7 of her most beloved songs. Okay, so we might talk about your music. That's what you chose.
Yes.
And I'll ask you what I ask most people. Did it take you long to come up with the
Some
songs?
Of them were very easy to choose and came straight away.
Yeah.
But others, because I wasn't actually exactly sure of the mission,
yep.
The brief, if you like, I kind of guessed at what it was from listening to a previous podcast.
Okay.
So I assumed it was part Desert Island Discs, part music that is important to me, part music that says something about me, and kind of went with that.
Cool. And that's 33% of each, or of each little bit?
That's too hard to judge.
Okay, so that's all the brief. It is Desert Island Discs. That's what I've stolen it from.
Okay.
So it's mainly just that. But...
And I'm sure if I had to do this again in 3 weeks' time, I might pick something different.
But... Oh, I mean, you might even do that tonight. You might be like, oh, why did I choose
yeah.
this song? This is okay.
Something
but...
else is way better.
Yeah. But we might start with Rabbit Heart by Florence and the Machine.
Okay. So I'm a big Florence and the Machine fan.
Yeah.
And this was the first song that really hooked me into her. I always thought it was her first song that she released because, but apparently Kiss with a Fist and one of the other ones was before that. But I'm not a big fan of that song, so I guess I didn't really remember hearing it on the radio.
Yeah.
And this song, I don't know, it really appeals to, the themes appeal to kind of my values and I like her voice and it reminded me a lot of, there's a story by an author called Angela Carter who takes all these kind of fairy tales and twists them around.
I think you've lent me a book of Angela Carter. Do you
possibly,
have...
called The Bloody Chamber.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
She takes these fairy tales and instead of them being, you know, the woman has to be rescued by the man and that's the only way to get ahead in life, she twists them around and the female characters take control of their own destinies and rather than wait around for a man to come and rescue them. And there's a line in one of the stories, the tiger will never lie down with the lamb. He acknowledges no pact that is not reciprocal. The lamb must learn to run with the tigers. And this song instantly made me think of that. And it's not exactly what it's about, but there was some kind of connection there about kind of taking responsibility for yourself. And I think Rabbit Heart is about what people do to themselves.
Yeah.
And, taking responsibility for that and deciding who you want to be and what you want to do with yourself.
What do you mean, the things they do to themselves?
Well, in Rabbit Heart, I could be totally wrong about this, but I think Rabbit Heart is about people's, perhaps women in particular, letting kind of society affect how they view themselves and in terms of their looks. There's comments about the Midas touch and
yeah.
what I do to myself and sort of looking in the mirror and how other people view my appearance and do I let other people make me feel bad about how I look and how I feel I'm portraying myself to the world. Whereas you have to just, I think, say no to a lot of that stuff for the sake of saying no to it.
Is that hard, though? Is that...
I think it can be. And it's really easy to get sucked in by it all. And particularly if you spend a lot of time with people who care a lot about their appearance.
Yeah.
To get caught up in, like, the makeup and the hair and the fake tan and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But then, I know there's been lots of times where I've been on holidays with people or spent a lot of time with people who spend all this time on this stuff, and I just feel, ugh, in it after a while. Like, it's
yeah.
kind of nice, and I'm not a total tomboy, and I wear makeup and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
But it's not a actually, to quote something else, there's a That's great, fine. There's that not so great movie adaptation of Little Women from the 90s that Winona Ryder was in, and there's a great line in it where the eldest daughter is sort of preening herself and wearing makeup, and the mother sort of criticizes her a little bit, and she says, "Oh, but I, you know, it's fun and it's part of this kind of cult women's culture and so on." And the mother says to her, "But if that's where your priorities lie, then that's all you'll ever be." And I thought, yes, that's how I feel about this stuff. And it is kind of, I kind of grew up not feeling confident about how I looked. And so therefore I kind of took the stance of, well, it shouldn't matter how you look.
Yeah.
And I didn't care about how I looked. And it does matter to a certain extent. But not so much that it, like, takes over your life.
Yeah.
And but, go on.
But it does. It does for a lot of people, doesn't it?
I think so.
I mean, again, you know, I said we weren't going to talk much about school, but you see that horribly played out day after day on the
teenage
playground.
Teenage girls with swathes of makeup over their faces, yeah, and stuff like that.
And they're usually the younger ones, too, that they're getting the makeup by just caking it on.
Trying it on, and they don't really know what... I feel this. You feel like coming up to some girls and, like, smudging their makeup line and that sort of stuff, blending it in a little bit. And
yeah, it tends to end at the chin. Yes. And it's all different colours.
Like a clown face. And
yeah.
Yeah. But, and it's kind of interesting that there is a lot more pressure on, it's all about women, but, I mean, I'm not a man, so I don't really know, but I wouldn't have thought there is that same amount of pressure on men to look a certain way.
I mean,
or is there?
I'm talking off the top of my head, so I don't think about it's about look, but I think, especially growing up, there's a thing about how guys act. So I think it's about
in
women.
In terms of butchness and all that
yeah,
sort of
how
stuff.
Butchness is probably not the right term, but if how women, I know, a scene to look is very much how I feel the pressure is on how men act. And again, I'm like with you, I can't stand that whole macho crap. I hate seeing
heads.
Yeah,
and all that
I
sort of stuff.
I mean, I was a footy head. I like playing footy, and footy was great, but I was never one for the bravado is really fake, and it really troubles me, and I feel really uncomfortable around it. I think a lot of my friends do too.
Yeah.
Is we're never ones for, we are men with men, and because that, it just sort of...
To me and some of my friends at school, it seemed fake to us as well.
Yeah.
And so for women not to see through that, I don't really get that either.
Yeah.
I had a friend at high school who went out with this horrible, horrible boy, and that's all he did. He was so unsure of himself.
Yeah.
He was one of the less cool kids on the football team of all the really cool kids, so he put on this bravado all the time.
Yeah.
And so this other friend of mine, we'd have this little code for when we were sick of this guy going with this crap all the time.
Yeah.
And we'd sing Nacho, Nacho Man.
That's a very obscure code. That's nice. No one would ever work that one out.
So, he was just irritating.
Yeah. I mean, it carries on in, like, adult life, and it's always a danger playing team sports because that's where a lot of it is centered, in that rubbish bravado and, again, that men with men, and it's this weird homoerotic thing where
homophobia of it. Like,
we are men, but you can grab each other's ass, and that's fine, but that's gay, and no, you can't be gay, really,
and,
but you can
know,
touch
AFL
each...
versus rugby league. I'm like, what?
Yeah, it's so
the
odd.
The homophobia
and,
is
awful. But we're getting far, far away from Florence and the Machine as possible, as we always do, but... Well, the reason I wanted to talk about that first is because we actually saw her together.
Yes, she was amazing.
Yeah.
That was awesome.
And that was like another thing of the event and the lead up to it. Because we went up, just me and Justine and you and
Emma
another teacher. And we all went up together, and it was just, it's very rare. We having children, it doesn't happen too often.
Away.
But when you do it, that was great. And the concert was...
She was, I just remember, I think the drumming song was what opened it.
Yeah.
And the curtain, did it go up or down or something strange?
I think it fell,
and it
yeah.
just, those drums, and
she was
in that crazy dress,
yeah.
and she was pirouetting around the stage, and
she's
was
so
awesome.
Tiny, and
yeah.
she's got
this
just
huge voice,
voice
that comes out of her.
I remember what was the song that finished that concert? Dog Day Afternoon? Dog Dog Days Are Over. She came out as Al Pacino. It was great. Dog Days Are Over, when she came out, that was amazing. Everyone got everyone to jump at the same time. And I was just like, just she's so tiny. That was the thing. How do you command such a big presence?
It's talent, I think, a lot of it.
Yeah.
And that absolute confidence in what you're doing. And the ability to sing, and it's not, I have to hide behind this instrument.
No, that's true.
Kind of make do with a song that you all love, and I'll just kind of sing through it.
Yeah. No, that's true.
She knows
true.
What she's doing, and she can do it without having to really think about it.
We're going to move on to song two, not Blur song two.
Which got number 22 in the radio music poll that was on yesterday, apparently.
You can name them. They're not a sponsor or anything. It's okay. Fine. But yeah, that was yesterday, the Hottest 100. So, but we won't talk about that.
No.
If you want to complain, there's plenty of avenues for you to do that. And yes, the second song I wanted to talk to you about was Distant Sun by Crowded House.
Okay, I actually got into this song from, I know you don't like it very much, but that She Will Have Her Way, female covers kind of album.
It's not that I don't like it, I just heard it, I don't know, maybe when we came back from Japan and I was staying with...
Oh, was it in preparation for your wedding or something?
Yeah, that's right, we came back and it was on...
All the time.
On someone who was staying with, loved it, and it was just on for 2 weeks. I was over it after about a day, hearing it three times in a day. So who covered it? Who covered it?
Oh, some like New Zealand country singer, Brooke, somebody, I don't really remember. And I think it was just from doing long car trips to Sydney or something and finding something to sing to. And then I sort of was like listening to this song, like, that's really cool.
Yeah, it is a cool song.
When I was growing up, there was my parents weren't Crowded House fans and none of my friends were, and I sort of got into them, I think I was about 18 or something, and I was in a CD shop and I saw this, like, Best of Crowded House.
Recurring Dream was pretty massive when it came out. That was...
And I didn't have any Crowded House, and I know I'd heard songs on the radio, and I thought, I'll buy this.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow.
It's pretty consistently great.
This guy's really clever. Yeah. Like, it's not this literal... I'm going to repeat these three lines over and over again kind of thing. All these quirky metaphors and stuff. And I just think Distant Sun's really clever. But it's a basic song about, I really like you, but I don't quite know what's going to happen, but I don't care.
Yeah.
But it's kind of couched in all this kind of figurative language and stuff. So you're like, is it about that? Yes, it is.
It is. I'm sure that's... I mean, the line that always sticks in my head is that I don't pretend to know what you want.
Yeah.
And I think that's I was 18 when the Best Of album came out and I listened to it. I was like, that's a really good line to say to a girl, is that I really like you, but I don't know, I'm not going to pretend to know who you are.
And I think it's an important thing when you're starting off like a relationship with someone, when you have no idea what you're doing.
Yeah.
And, like, the communication's really bad, and if the two people aren't really comfortable about being themselves around the other person, and then how it all... If you have misunderstandings about things and how that all works out.
Yeah.
and just trying to lay it out there. We're going, I don't know, you need to tell me what's going on, kind of stuff.
Yeah, I mean, that's all it is, really, is, oh, those first moments of anxiety.
Yeah.
Especially after, if it starts off really well, oh, everything's going...
And then real life kind of sets in.
You're like, oh, my God, I don't know what's going on. And,
mm-hmm.
and yeah, it's all in the in your head, yes. basically. Yes,
invent all this stuff in your head, all the overanalyze everything.
Yeah.
And it's nothing like that at all.
No. And, I think one thing that I do... really badly is that it's play out things in your head.
Yeah. So it's not just a women's thing. That's excellent to hear.
Well, not like, yeah, I guess. No, but I think I do it in, obviously, my relationship, but I do it a lot of the time where I predict conflict and, this is totally off the point, but maybe devise how to... justify my actions, but then it never eventuates. Like
kind of the same thing, but I think mine comes from the fact that I hate confrontation.
Yeah,
and I'm not very good with it. I often just burst into tears. It's not like I plan to turn on the waterworks and want to use it to manipulate
that
somebody.
That may be a girl thing more than a guy thing.
But trying to predict, right, I'm going to say this, and if they say this, then I'm going to say this, but if they say this, then I'll reply with such and such.
Yeah.
And then the conflict never happens at all.
No.
I had these, like, pretend conversations about nothing.
I spend a lot of my ride home or ride to work thinking of those kinds of things and going, what am I doing this for?
Yeah.
It's not worth it. Anyway, so getting back to the song. The chorus or the line, like, is it blood from a distant sun?
Oh.
Will shower over everyone? I'm pretty sure that's the line.
Is it blood?
Oh, maybe it's not even blood.
I should have done some more research, maybe
I should have done the research.
I thought it was dust from a distant sun.
Oh, it might be dust from a distant sun. It's probably dust more than blood.
I don't know.
Blood sounds a bit full on, doesn't it?
Dust as in...
No, it is dust.
Well,
is dust,
I would... It's sort of the haze that comes from this amazing thing that
I might
you
edit
think...
that out to make me sound really stupid. Yeah, sorry.
Isn't there a name for that? When you think a word in a song is something else?
Mondegreen or something? Yeah, that's right, yeah. Yes.
I had a friend in high school who thought Kate Sobrano's Bedroom Eyes was Petrolize.
Petrolize?
Petrolize.
Wow. Petrolize?
Even blood from a distant sun makes a little more sense.
Yeah, no, I don't think I bought... No, never mind. I'll stop talking about that. But so you mentioned before, like, you travelled overseas. And one thing about Crowded House that I've learnt is that they're huge around the world. It's one of those bands that if it comes on anywhere in the world, look, people know
like
it.
Well, where I was living in Oxford and... the local radio station, Weather With You was on the radio every single day.
Really?
It was quite strange, but a slightly different version. I think they had like one less verse or an extra verse or something.
Okay.
Every day it was on. None of their other songs, but Weather With You was on just about every day.
Wow. How annoying.
Yes.
But I think it was when I lived in Japan and sing karaoke and if you sang a Crowded House song, like everyone seemed to know people from America, Canada, New Zealand, obviously New Zealand, but like and Japan, they all seem to know all these songs. I think they're just...
And maybe as Australians, we weren't as aware of their international kind of popularity.
Yeah.
Or, because I mean, they were big in the 80s, I guess, was their heyday, was it?
Yeah, I guess.
80s, early 90s, and I was still a kid and you don't really know what's going on when you're a kid.
Yeah, I remember a few songs coming out, but you never really gave them much thought. Like, they were nice to listen to, but you never, like you said before, look at the lyrics and...
Yeah.
Or listen to the lyrics and try to pick them apart. He had really nice melody and...
They kind of give me... Well, I came to them sort of later in life, and I think maybe that's what a lot of people do. When you're sick of listening to those stupid, inane pop songs...
Yeah.
And your tastes start to mature as you grow up, and Crowded House are a group who maybe people find as they get a bit older and...
I guess there's a bit of that where
something a bit different.
Where it is it's a bit of a step up, like you said. Still got the nice catchy melody and the nice tune, and then I'm gonna think about this one.
Yeah.
And try and work out what the hell Pineapple
Head
is about.
Of it, yeah.
Still haven't worked that one out.
Yeah.
But
I don't know.
things you would change. I don't pretend to know what you want. When you come around and spin my talk, time and again, time and again. No fire where I lit my spark. I am not afraid of the dark. Where your words devour my heart and put me to shame, put me to shame. Shower over everyone.
So I wanted to talk to you about your travelling, more importantly the fact that you went to Cambodia.
Yes, so I had some friends who the previous year, and one of them even the year before that, had done a house building trip to Cambodia. So, I don't know, the friend who kind of started it all off, I'm not really sure how she got into it, but it was for an organisation called the Tabitha Foundation, and a woman, Jan, I've forgotten her last name, a Canadian, what do you call those people who go and spread religion around the world?
Pilgrim? I don't know.
God, I'm an English teacher, why do I not know this word? Anyway, she went to Cambodia in the early 90s when the UN had stepped in and started to get rid of the Khmer Rouge, and she went there to kind of do humanitarian work, and it was awful. She said she had to sleep in her bathtub and stuff because there'd be shooting rampages at night time, and it was the only way to not get shot in your bed. Anyway, so she started off, and it's non-religious based at all, but a program, instead of just giving aid to the Cambodians, it's a bit like a bank. So their workers will like invest like $2 from these, you know, really poor people, and it's all their savings, and like help them in, like they'll buy chickens or a pig or something like that. And then for some people who are really, really disadvantaged, like widows or single mothers or someone with HIV or something like that, the charity will actually give them a house. And so they kind of work with communities, and the village will elect who will get the houses. So if there's a, like there was I think 13 or 15 teachers who said, yep, we'll go and build houses. And then we all did fundraising activities with our schools, and then a few months beforehand we sort of said to Jan, right, we have this much money, therefore we can build 13 houses or whatever it was.
Wow.
And so then the village sort of talk to each other about who should get the houses, and then they choose. And so it was amazing. A really great experience. The house building itself wasn't physically as hard as I had expected.
Yeah.
But we sort of did had a day of introductions where Jan talked to us and talked to us about the history of the country and what the Khmer Rouge did to the country and to the people. And we went to a place called Tol Sleng, S21, which is like a prison for political criminals, so met people who were supposedly members of the party,
yeah,
who were, you know, being portrayed, or, you know, the typical totalitarian horrors. And I think it was sort of like set free by a Vietnamese photographer or something, came across it in 1975, and they've still got beds where people were chained to it and tortured. But it used to be a school.
Yeah.
So there was, like, the sort of first part you walk into, there are these big, long buildings. And on the ground floor, I think there was, like, 8 classrooms. And there's this sort of metal bed with a mattress, it's just the springs and stuff. And on the photo, on the wall is a photo of the body that was found on the bed when the photographer came across it.
Oh, God.
But there's a chalkboard there, and you can still see the chalk of, like, the maths equations or the notes or whatever that the teacher had written on the board. Like, it's just this bizarre conflict between this horrible stuff that happened.
Yeah.
But it was like a school. But this chalk has stayed there all that time kind of thing. Like, it's a nice, in amongst all that horrible stuff, this chalk has remained.
Did it have like an impact on you, like while you were there, or did
oh
it,
definitely,
or when you was it more when you came home or?
Not so much when I was there. When I had been in Europe a few years beforehand, and I went to a Jewish concentration camp near Munich, I've forgotten its name, I was sobbing before I even walked in the place because I'd knew what it was all about and
yeah.
not worked myself up, but fully understood what I was going to be looking at.
Yeah.
And I kind of expected S21, and we also went to one of the killing fields, and I sort of expected that same reaction to happen. And maybe because we'd been told all about it and you knew what happened there, but I think maybe because it wasn't, knowing about what happened to the people of Cambodia is not a big part of our culture, like knowing about what happened to the Jewish people
during the
Second World War. So I had a few weeks of knowledge compared with a whole cultural kind of background contributing to that.
Yeah.
So, I don't know whether it had a greater impact on me when I was there or when I came away. But definitely when we're in the village the next day, and with a few of the houses, the people who were going to live there helped us. So the floors were made of, these houses were basically like sheds on stilts, but way better than what the people had, like sleeping under leaves and sticks and stuff.
God.
So when we arrived, all the kind of main foundations were, the main sort of big poles were put out, and the floor kind of scaffolding stuff was out, and the floor was going to be made of strips of bamboo, so that was all laid out, and we had to start by nailing all that down. And there was this old man who was like passing me nails to hammer in, and all the other villagers who were around at the end of each day, we got photos with everyone. And you're trying to build their houses, but you're thinking all the time, particularly like there's very few elderly people left in Cambodia because they were killed during the Khmer Rouge years after.
That is something that is really hard to fathom, isn't it?
Yeah. And just the complete, like it's permanently changed these people who are still alive. And like Jan said to us, you will hardly see anybody wearing spectacles in Cambodia.
Because
like
if you're intellectual,
people, yeah,
they
you were
killed.
And wearing spectacles was a sign that you could read, and so middle-aged people and above don't wear them. And that's just been drilled into them for those horrible years that they experienced. And it just completely changes everything. And we also had, was it the trip I went on or a friend of mine on another trip? One of the families, to thank her for her work building the house, offered Kate their child. Yeah, you know, they were so grateful that they were going to give their baby away in gratitude.
Wow.
You just think, oh my God.
Yeah, that's a different world, isn't it?
It's horrendous.
Hi, just interrupting for a second to give you the information about the Tabitha Foundation of Australia. Emily hasn't asked me to do this. I just thought it would be a good time to do it. It's at www.tabitha.org.au. Check it out. They do a lot of good work for a lot of little money. So, yeah, Peachy by Missy Higgins.
Well, I really like this song. As you would know, it's a bit of a karaoke staple of mine. Not that I do karaoke that much, but anyway. I think The Sound of White was Missy Higgins' first album, and I never really got into that. I find it really depressing to listen to, even now after a couple of her other albums. I still don't really... It's got really good songs on there, but to listen to the whole thing is too much. And then Peachy, I think, was released the same year as Steer, and I remember when I still drove a car that only had a cassette player. I remember recording the Hottest 100 one year, so I had something else to listen to in the car.
Yeah.
And on this tape, I had Steer and Peachy. And Steer is great.
Yeah.
But Peachy, I just really liked. Because I guess kind of like that stuff we were talking about before with relationships, and you have all this stuff inside your head, but that's not really how it is, and you overanalyze everything. And I really like Peachy because I have never come across another song that's really about the kind of when those relationships fall apart and that kind of blaming, well, he's a bastard and blah, 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 you did all the wrong stuff.
Yeah.
Before you get to that point of stepping back and having that perspective and going, well, actually, maybe I was a bit of a shit too. And it's just about that those misunderstandings, but not yet being aware that it was a misunderstanding, if that makes any sense.
Yeah.
So, I don't know, I've always just really liked it, and that got me hooked into Missy Higgins. And her latest album I don't think is that great.
Yeah.
But there's been moments in my life where, you know, low points or something goes on and whatever, but I come across a song that's exactly how I'm feeling right then.
Yeah.
And she's just able to, or I'm able to find something in a song of hers that just puts into song what I'm feeling then, and singing to it in the car is a bit of a cathartic kind of thing.
You can see why, like, if you're the writer or the singer of those songs, like, I've heard lots of people talk about how people come up to them and are really intense and, like, yeah, you understand. Like,
yes, I'm not alone in the world and all this sort of stuff.
Yeah, and to them it's just a bunch of stuff that happened to them and they put it down on paper. But, I mean, obviously that's, you know, part of their goal is to do that, is to hope, well, this will help or this will...
But I think that's the... One of the things that makes a really good song, whether it's a pop song or whatever else, but when the audience can make that emotional connection to it, it's not just these kind of nice lyrics and it's not just about this thing that I went through with my boyfriend or whatever, but you can actually hear it and feel it in the music. Yeah. It's not just the words.
It's hard. The thing that like pop can't manufacture is that they can try to manufacture the sincerity, but you can tell.
Yeah.
Very, very quickly, especially on stage more than anything else.
Yes.
You can do all you want producing it, but on stage, if you're not sincere, then it comes off.
And I think, like we were talking before about Florence.
Yeah.
Or anyone who's great on stage, they're conveying that emotion as well, and that's what sucks you in.
Well, Justine and I saw Bruce Springsteen in March, and, you know, like, I'm not the biggest fan as she is. But he's 66 and he's played some of the songs thousands and thousands of times, but he still conveys it with all the.
But I guess it's kind of the same with actors. I mean, I don't really know much about acting, but what I've heard about it is that what you sort of learn to do is when you're playing this character who is nothing like you, trying to find that kind of connection or where you felt something that's kind of similar. So you're performing it from that emotional place rather than pretending to be that person.
Yeah.
It's not my fault, it can't be my fault that you speak to me the way you do. Now I'm split in two, I'm half me and half you, but I hate us both, don't you? It can't be your fault that I let you fall inside my head. 'Cause now you know my places and you know that face, but I hate this taste, don't you? No, of course you don't, of course you don't. You say life is peachy without me. Of course you don't, of course you don't.
But I want to get back to what you said about how it's a karaoke favourite.
Oh, yeah.
Because Emily sang this at karaoke one night and it was awesome. I didn't even know you were singing. I had my back.
What?
Yeah, no, I had my back to The,
oh, you didn't even want to watch me. Thank you, Matt.
Well, I didn't know you'd gone up. I was pretty drunk, and I'm sure you were too.
Oh, yes. I'd have to be.
You have to, yes, that's karaoke. True. You do tell me that. Yes, you have to be. But I remember it starting and then going, oh, and turning around and going, oh, my God, that's Emily. Mm. She can sing, but she has to be drunk to sing.
Yes. If I could do any job in the world and not have to worry about money or ability or anything, I'd love to sing for a living.
Really?
It'd be great. Not to do, like, have some horrible pop career or something, but I think it'd be amazing just to open your mouth and all this great stuff comes out of it. It'd be a great job to do, but yeah. I just...
There's a lot of risk involved in...
Oh, a huge amount of risk. It's not exactly the most financially stable career ever.
No.
And I might be able to sing at karaoke, but in terms of making a living out of it, no, it's something completely different.
Well, maybe it has happened, but I think there are a lot of people who think they're going to sing at karaoke and a man in the crowd's going to walk up.
I'm a producer. Here's my card.
I'm a big money producer. Here's a contract.
And
yeah, it never seems to... Never hear many of those stories.
And just... But even it wouldn't be just singing for a living. All the other stuff that you have to do.
Oh, yeah.
Just be horrendous.
Totally. God knows awful. How they do it.
Unless you were like the best person in the whole world, which is pick and choose what you wanted to do.
I'm going to sing for 3 minutes and then that's it. I'd be doing concerts in the middle of the day. That's what I'd be doing. I'm not staying up all hours of the night.
Yeah, I can sleep in whenever I want to.
Yeah.
And sing what I want. And...
But yes, it's... You know, yes, you have a very good voice, but yes, I do like the idea that you have to be drunk to sing it. And when living in Japan, that's true for 95% of people, really, is the drunker you get, the better you sound.
Because you just don't care. It's part of that losing your inhibition
stuff.
Yeah,
exactly.
That you just... What was the comment about Justine's performance?
Two hands, no fear. And no fear, that's right. And that's... Yeah, it is important. Because it's like a performance. It's not singing. It's
where
not real
you,
singing.
You shouldn't worry about what people think about you.
No.
Because it's better when you just sing it. Yeah.
Because everyone's there. No one's there to go, oh, you know, and they don't walk out and go, oh, what? That was terrible singing at karaoke last night. What a waste of money.
No. People don't think that. No. But it's like with most things, like public speaking or whatever.
Yeah.
I think a lot of kids are... terrified that all the other kids are judging them and saying horrible things about them. They don't care.
No.
Like, they're just worried about their own speech. You know, exactly. I'm sure there's times when there's bullies in the class who were just awful, but it's a very small minority of kids, I would think.
Oh, totally. But they would see they're going, oh, I couldn't do that. Oh, God.
But it could be part of that coming from teenagers, but part of human nature, thinking that you're kind of the center of the universe and everything's about you, so all these people must be thinking this stuff about me.
Yeah.
When they're not at all.
No, they never do.
No.
There's a line, a David Foster Wallace line, I better get this right, otherwise Nick will kill me, which is you wouldn't care so much about what people were thinking about you if you realized how little they think of you.
Yeah.
And that, which I always, that's always one that I dish out to the students from time to time, like, just people don't care that much. No. Like you said, they're worried about their own crap.
Yeah.
And hoping no one realises that they're messed up.
Yeah.
As everyone else. But we do have to crack on because we've got 7 songs. And the next one I want to talk to you about, which is Mary by Sparkadia, which has been stuck in my head.
I know.
For the last
it's
3
amazing.
Days. Because I've heard of Sparkadia and I've heard it on the radio, but I've never... Listen to it, and so I listened to it maybe 2 or 3 times, and today I was
well, you should hear it live, Matthew.
Oh my
Hooli
God,
dooli.
Yes! I remember you told me that. You said they were the best.
Yes.
Concert you've seen live.
I haven't. Well, there's probably a lot of people who've seen a lot more gigs than I have, but they was just amazing. Alex Burnett is kind of he is Sparkadia, I think, because his backing band keeps changing and dropping out on him all the time.
Yeah.
But he's, like we were talking about before with Florence, so much charisma and just all the attention was kind of like sucked to him. Not that the rest of the band were bad, but he just totally commanded everything.
Yeah.
It was totally hot. And he's not, because he's sort of, you look at him in photos and he's this kind of like pasty guy with a bit of a quiff happening.
Yeah, I saw him on a film clip and I was like, okay.
But he's so talented. Apparently on, what's the album called? The Great Impression.
Yeah.
I could have this wrong, but apparently he played all the instruments on there and then it was mixed together afterwards.
Wow.
And he just, he's just so talented and amazing at what he did. And the instrumentation is really interesting, and the rest of the band were really good as well when I saw them live. It was just great. And for Mary, they had these like gospel singers come on in robes, and it's got that kind of evangelical
Kind
of thing about it, and it was great. Well, it's the first song I really liked of theirs, because they had a previous album called Postcards, which isn't as great as The Great Impression, but it's still good. But the first time I really got into them, they had a song, Talking Like I'm Falling Downstairs, which is one of those other songs where I was like, that's about me. That's how I feel all the time. Get tongue-tied, and I have this stuff in my head I want to say, and then it never comes out right, and I just feel stupid and that sort of stuff. And I was like, this is really interesting kind of stuff. And then I think their album was like the, what do they call that album of the week thing on Triple J?
Featured album.
Yeah. So I heard it and really liked it, and then I went along with a friend of mine, and Talking Like I'm Falling Downstairs is what I wanted to hear, and this friend Emma said, I want to hear Mary, and I think the tour was called the Mary Tour, and I'd kind of remembered it, but not really, and then when they played it, I was like totally blown away. I'm hooked, completely hooked.
Yeah.
So.
Was it one that you played on, like, over and over?
Over and over again. Yeah, definitely. So.
And it's pretty uplifting, and... Like, my girls were like, ooh.
It sounds uplifting, but the lyrics are not. No,
that's right, that's right. Like, but the power in his voice and the... Because, like I said, it attracts your ear very quickly.
Yeah, definitely.
Well, I'll play, like, a minute or so at the end, and everyone will be like, oh. And you might go, oh, whatever, but
we'll hear it. Even after I came to Love Spycadia, I met someone who is a musician and a pianist, and he kind of makes his own music and stuff. And I was talking to him about the music that I liked, and he asked me to play some of it for him, and he was like, oh, listen to this, and listen to this stuff about all the kind of instrumentation and things in it that I hadn't really picked up on before, but how much kind of depth there is and how interesting it is, and it's pretty amazing.
Yeah, I will be getting the album, I'm sure, because... I listened to this, and then I listened to a few other
songs. China is great as well.
Yeah, that was the next one, and I listened to that, and then I was like, ooh, I might have to peruse. So when did you see them perform? Was this last year, or is it...
Oh, a year before, maybe?
Oh, okay.
Just at UC.
Yeah.
Yeah, tiny space, and we're right up near the front, which always makes a bit of a difference, I think.
Yeah.
Really kind of interesting backing band. There was a guy on keyboards who had this funny sort of black hat on, but he was... Well, my friend called him Asperger's Man because he looked very focused on what he was doing, did not want to make eye contact with anybody else. He was a bit odd. And then one of the guitarists looked like this crazy kind of East German guy with this blonde hair and all in black and kind of rocking away on the guitar and stuff. And it was great.
Wow. Yeah, when those concerts hit, they're always it's pretty interesting, like where your brain goes. That's what I always find. It's always like I'm self-conscious at the best of times, but like just even dancing at concerts, I'm always like, yeah, and then I'll go, oh, wait, what if people are looking at me dance? Like, it's horrible. I wish I could just stop. But when the music's good, that all goes away.
And no one cares.
No one cares. Why would they look at you dancing and go, oh, look at him dancing stupidly? Because
they're just dancing to their own little world.
I really want to see this performer. Yeah, it's so weird.
A great concert can make such a difference to your opinion of those performers.
Yeah.
Like when the Jezebels first started getting going, and I really liked a lot of their songs, and I saw them once at a festival, and then at another gig, a friend kind of dragged me along, and they were just a bit boring. They were just like they sound on the CD, and...
Yeah.
I was like, yeah, I'm over it now. Like... No kind of interest for me anymore.
Yeah, it can be disheartening. It's a risk, isn't it? Especially if you go and see a band that you love or have loved for ages and you're like, oh, what if they suck?
Yeah.
And crush my spirits. Yeah. And I have to convince myself and go, oh, yeah, it was okay. That song was good and that song was...
Yeah.
Which is, I mean, I think any of those bands that have been around for a long time that perform, I reckon the first few songs... There's that in the air, you know. Like,
is it going to be good or are they going to have a shocker?
Yes, I've heard.
And because when you hear stories about all these people who've had great careers, when they crash and burn, like, you know, Whitney Houston or Barry, what's his face at the...
Barry White?
Yes. Yeah, when you hear horror stories like that.
Where he sat down and turned the beast back to the audience or didn't want to sing or... Yeah. It is horrible. I mean, I had a chance to see Bob Dylan when I was at uni.
Oh, wow.
I remember I went and bought like a Bob Dylan CD and the guy behind the counter was like, oh, he's playing in Newcastle in like a couple of days. And I was like, oh, wow. And he was like, I've got a spare ticket. And I was like, I don't want to see
this old man.
If he's really bad, then I don't want to see that.
Yeah.
Because I've heard, you know, I've heard good stuff and I've heard he just mumbles and that would just, oh, it just was be destroying. I didn't go and see him. But I've heard, from people that, both ends of the spectrum. Yeah. He played for 3 hours and he was really good. Oh no, he just mumbled through 80 minutes and then got off stage.
Oh, God.
I mean, my dad went to see Meatloaf. God, I don't know how long ago that was. And apparently, he was really awesome then. But
you hear so many stories.
Yeah, about how bad he is. You just go, oh well, depends how he's feeling, I guess. Yeah. They're old. They get sick.
And it must be like you hear young performers talk about how kind of draining it is.
Yeah.
For older people, I'm only in my early 30s. I have enough trouble, regular amounts of sleep and doing what I'm supposed to do.
Well, that was the thing again. Like, when we went and saw Bruce Springsteen, it said, concert starts at 7:30. And we're like, cool, we rock up there at 8 o'clock. And he's, six songs in. He's 66. Wants to get out of there by 10 o'clock and go to bed.
But it's kind of nice. You can still get go and see a great concert and get a full night's sleep.
Yeah, we were like, why did we think of that? He's in his mid-60s. He should know, we should know.
They actually start on the time it says on the ticket.
Yeah.
Wowzers.
Yeah. People with children, I've heard. If the band's gone and have kids, then they start much earlier and they start on time and they get out.
They should all start breeding.
Yeah, and just get out of there.
Mary, I don't know what to do, Mary, 'cause every time I look away from you, you're all I see, Mary. If the pulse shifts the present, then presently I would be living it differently now. The upside of downtime's is
okay, well, we'll look at another band who's not going to tour ever, which is the Beatles. Now, you said you had to have a Beatles song in here.
Yes.
Why did you have to have a Beatles song?
Because I'm a bit of a 60s music nerd.
You like the Turtles?
Well, Happy Together is a great song.
It is a good song.
And what's that other one? Eleanor?
Eleanor, yeah.
So
sorry, that was just any time I play trivia, I would just throw that one out. It's the Turtles. Really? Oh.
Well, on Spicks and Specks one night, there was a question, they played a Zombies song.
Yeah.
And the answer, who sang this song? And no one knew it, not even Alan Brough, and I'm shouting at the television, it's the Zombies!
Yeah, those shows are never good that way, shouting at the
television. It never works.
I knew more, that one question. If I was on that show, I would have pressed that buzzer and everyone would have clapped.
Yeah.
Could have.
But even, I don't care about the clapping, I just want to get it right.
Yeah.
So, yes. So particularly my dad listened to heaps of 50s and 60s music when I was growing up. And so it was a big part of my childhood, I guess. I remember being woken up at 6 o'clock on Saturday mornings to Real Wild Child being blasted at 20,000 decibels out of the stereo.
Wow. That's
really interesting. And then when I was a teenager, that show Heartbeat was on, that British show set in Yorkshire, and they had a really great soundtrack.
Yeah,
and I remember watching it a lot, and my parents bought the soundtrack, and that's when I really started to kind of get into it.
Yeah.
And, but that was about the same time when those Beatles anthologies were released in the mid-90s, so I had a few friends who were getting into it, and was being becoming popular.
Yeah. Yeah, I got into the Beatles probably 94, 95. Well, my dad had them all, but yeah, that was exactly the same. And all of a sudden,
my parents were not Beatles fans at all. They both, when they were younger, bought the single For Get Back. They both loved that song and both have that single.
That's but cool.
Didn't just really
independent
like
of each other.
That's funny. Kind of weird. But they never were really Beatles fans. And then I kind of, I don't know, I just got into it a bit more. And I think there were these sort of like best of albums. One was like red and one blue. There's photos of them at Eon Our House or something. And so I had those. And then slowly I've been starting to buy the proper albums and finding other great songs. Like I've talked to you about On Revolver, Got to Get You Into My Life, and other great songs like that.
Yeah, that's the amazing thing, isn't it? I think that's why, it's like, they're, you know, I'm a bit one-eyed when it comes to the Beatles, but I think they're still, if it's possible, they're underrated. Because people only listen to the, like you said, those red and the blue, the number one singles, and they go, yeah, they were really great. But then you, when you listen to, like you said, Revolver, where on earth was this made?
Yeah.
Like, what? 1966 or whatever? Like, they made... Because for me, that's the best album.
Yeah,
probably. Like, it's so weird.
I like Revolver better than the other ones I've listened to.
Yeah.
And I don't really know why. I like that middle period of theirs.
Yeah,
between the real corniness and the, like, wacky sitars and all this, like, drug-induced rubbish.
Yeah.
Not all of it's rubbish.
Revolver is the drug-induced stuff, though.
Yeah, but... It's not self-consciously I'm going to be experimental and all this kind of pretentious, what I think is pretentious stuff.
Yeah.
And I'm sure that someone could explain some stuff to me that would make me a little bit more generous, in my opinion. But yeah, I'd like that middle period before it became too...
I think I don't mean. And I think like the self-awareness, like I think Sgt. Pepper's was that tipping point of, why don't we create a different band? Because we're the biggest... Like,
yeah.
I think...
But I do like Sgt. Pepper. Like, who doesn't like When I'm 64? Really?
It's okay.
I just think it's really nice.
It is nice, I guess. It's a bit twee and... I don't know.
But I like the idea of these people who are, like, mega rich and so famous.
Yeah.
They could make this, like, really simple Oompa Loompa kind of sounding thing.
Yeah.
I guess that was a conscious part of it, trying to sound like that and have that kind of contrast and all the rest of it.
But... That's true. I mean, but the song you've chosen, which is While My Guitar Gently Weeps, which is obviously an amazing song, just fantastic. Amazing guitar, amazing lyrics. Yeah. Did you like that song, like when you had the... That would be on the Blue album.
Yes.
Did you like it?
I think it was on the White album. Originally.
It was on the White album, yeah.
I actually got into this song because when I was at uni the first time around, I did a subject about the history of the 60s and I got to do an assignment on the Beatles.
That's so
it was like the best subject I've ever done. And I remember because we had to do each week, someone had to present a shoot paper on the set topics. And I remember reading the book and seeing there was a Beatles one. And I was like waiting and trying to jump in front of anyone. And no one else interested in doing the Beatles assignment. What is wrong with you people? and the question was something like discuss how the Beatles music reflected the changing preoccupations of the 1960s.
Oh my God.
But it was great. So
it's
I had to kind of research all the stuff that happened in the 60s and look at all, like, as many Beatles songs as I could from kind of beginning to end and try and figure out what they were about and sort of match it up with what was going on.
Yeah. Wow,
and
that's great.
So that's when I got into While My Guitar Gently Weeps, which I think was sort of 68 or something after, like, Charles Manson and all, like, everyone realised... Or, you know, everything was starting to fall apart. That the whole hippie counterculture thing is not going to change the world and we're not going to have this revolution and it's all falling apart.
I think, you know, nerdy me, that's George Harrison and I think and John Lennon went to the Summer of Love.
Oh, yeah.
And in San Francisco and all that in 67. And they, that's, like you said, that's a lot of that stuff that George Harrison wrote after that is reaction to that because...
Yeah.
he was hoping to see all the love and the beautiful ideas instead of just a lot of people really wasted and people taking advantage of people being really wasted and just people thinking it was the cool thing to do. And he said it was just quite a sad place.
So corrupted. And,
It was already corrupted really quickly. And it was, and you know, like an ideology is, of anything is people like, no, you're doing this wrong. And he said it, even that felt, he just said it felt wrong from as soon as they got there. So then a lot of that stuff is, okay, you think you're awesome, but.
And I think one of the reasons why I like that song is because my interest in the 60s has never really been about that hippie stuff.
Yeah.
But about the earlier kind of mod and like the British invasion and all that sort of stuff. And so when I was learning about how this kind of hippie love everyone kind of counterculture was like falling apart.
Yeah.
That, I don't know, I just found that really fascinating. And it's not... A lot of people, like younger people, have this idea that the 60s was all this kind of free love stuff. And you go to like a 60s costume party and they dress up as hippies. But there was so much more to it than that.
It's, it's a counterculture and it was so small.
It wasn't, the vast majority of society were not like that at all.
No, and that's really weird how that's sort of transcended and that's what people immediately think of. Yeah. But it was for like 2 years, 3 years
I
max.
And I think Australia was like 5 years behind that.
That's right, yeah.
Did that in the 70s.
In the early 70s, yeah. It's just an odd... I don't know why. Maybe it's nice to look back and go, yeah, we're all about peace and love, but no.
Or weren't. Like our people of our parents' generation trying to sound like they had this like great time. And
they're in a war, and they're in a war they didn't belong in, and that was what the majority of people... They all had conservative governments. And it's...
And I think... I remember reading something about, like, the highest-selling single of the 1960s was something... Or the highest-selling album was the Sound of Music soundtrack. You know, so that might not be correct, but it's something
it
along those
lines. It wouldn't
surprise
me. It's one of the highest, you know, one of the biggest money-making movies ever. It's, like, the second highest, I think, behind Gone with the Wind.
Probably.
For ticket sales, anyway. Yeah. But, so, like, while My Guitar Gently Weeps, do you... When you listen to it, does it make you feel... guilty? Do you think he's singing about you, or
no? I don't.
Do you think
guilty.
He's singing about other people?
I kind of like the. This sounds really mean, actually, but I kind of like. I support or I understand his criticism of people who. Think, oh, we're not going to have any rules at all and we'll just do all this lovely stuff and it'll be great and we'll change the world and it's the right thing to do. Well, actually, you didn't really do anything at all, and if you'd thought about that a little bit more, maybe it could have been a bit more successful.
I look at the world and I know this is turning.
Song number six, which I wanted to ask you about, and about philosophy as well. Maybe, I thought maybe it had something to do with your philosophy, which is Deeper Water by Paul Kelly, but maybe you just think it's a nice song.
It is a great song.
Yeah.
Again, like with, I guess, Crowded House and a lot of the people I listen to, I didn't really get into Paul Kelly until I was much older, a few years ago.
Yeah.
And it was one of those ones where you sort of hear the songs on the radio. I don't actually have any Paul Kelly music, and I bought his, like, best of, I think it's called Songs of the South or something.
Yeah.
I was like, this guy's amazing. And I knew, like, Dumb Things and those really big songs, but I never... I think his best songs are those stories that he has, tells.
Did that one have the... Was it two CDs or just
one? Yeah, two CDs.
Because we, Jazz and I, went to see him on the tour, I think, when he released the second CD, and he played all his hits, basically.
Yeah.
But there were still songs on that second CD that we'd never heard. And like you said, the story song. His voice is so clean, and the storytelling is so good. Like, the first time I heard that, then I got everything within that, which is amazing for a song. He came out and he sang, what song? They Thought I Was Asleep?
I love that song. It's beautiful.
Yeah, and I never heard it before. Justine never heard it, but you get everything. It's amazingly simple.
Like a great short story writer who picks up on these moments of these characters' lives and just tells this little story. And it totally sucks you in. And you don't need to hear the before and the after. You just need that little moment.
Yeah. And you get the emotion
that
right through it. But, I mean, Deeper Water is one of those songs, I think. For me, especially, I get goosebumps listening to it. It makes me feel
and
really
as
sad.
A parent, you must feel that even more.
Yeah, and it's sad. It's beautiful, and it's just horrifically sad. And, it's just
but
about life.
Any child who grew up near the ocean,
even
if you're not a parent, you can relate to that bit of your parents or a parent or an older sibling or whatever being with you in the ocean and that hesitation, I want to go out a bit deeper, but it's a bit scary and all that sort of stuff. And
and again, like the whole idea behind the song is the cycle of your life, basically. These things are going to happen.
And
you're going to get into deeper water in your life.
The insignificance of a person as well, even though there's these big momentous kind of occasions throughout your life.
Yeah.
In the grand scheme of things, you're just one little tiny person in a great big ocean.
Yeah, you know? And this is happening to everybody.
Yeah.
But and again, like having Violet and Noelle who love the ocean, it's, when I listen to it now, I'm like, damn it, I hate it when you get it. Yeah, he gets it so right, but it's...
Well, there's another song of his, which is probably the one that really made me love that album the best, called Everything's Turning to White.
Yeah.
And that's, like, it's horrible.
Yeah.
Horrible, horrible, horrible. But it's just so... Like, that moment of those characters' lives.
Yeah.
And this woman going, I don't want to be married to this horrible person anymore.
Yeah, he went fishing while someone was
dead
in the
water.
Yeah,
just left the body there because they couldn't be bothered.
They wanted to go fishing.
Yeah.
They were away with their mates.
And how, like, that's... The guts of the story is not about that woman.
Yeah.
But it's how it affects her and
that
kind of distancing of the characters and what is it... Who is it really about?
It's the same with... How to Make Gravy as well, again, he just writes, and you get the great sense of different characters in the same song, and a very clear sense of all these different people. So, how does it make you feel, or like when you listen to?
I love it is kind of uplifting, even though it's sad because the wife dies and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
It is, because it's left with that sense of it's okay, the cycle will go on, you will have joy in your life.
Yeah.
It is uplifting, I think. And also that sense of that other people experience the same stuff that you do, and people go through life worried about this and that and work and trying to balance out everything, but... And you sort of worry about, I hate my job, should I quit my job? Am I the only person who hates their job? What am I doing? Other people feel exactly the same way.
Mm-hmm.
You just don't live the life through other people's heads.
On a crowded beach in a distant time, at the height of summer, see a boy of five at the water's edge, so nimble and free, jumping over the ripples, looking way at the sea. Now a man comes up from amongst the throng, takes a young boy's hand, and his hand is strong, and the child feels safe, yeah, the child feels brave. I just carried in those arms up and over the waves, deeper water, deeper water, deeper water, it's calling him on.
We've come to the final song, which is I Got You Under My Skin by yes. Frank.
I do like
a bit of Frank.
Okay.
But I thought, oh, does Emily like this song? Is this on a soundtrack? And when I looked it up, it's a soundtrack of What Women Want, which is a Mel Gibson movie, which I've never seen. But apparently he takes on...
Anyway, he becomes...
A woman? I don't know. Something. That's what it looks like.
That movie has nothing to do with this song. Let me just say,
no, I figured I was
please do that. Not associate this song with that movie or that actor at all. I've always liked this song, and I think it, when I've been in relationships, it just says it all, because I kind of jump in head first and go full on into it without really stopping and thinking or trying to be a little bit reserved about it. But I don't know how I really got into swing music. I think my mum, when I was a kid, my mum listened to some Australian kind of light jazz stuff, like Grace Knight, and actually she had the soundtrack to Come In Spinner. It was like this miniseries on ABC based on a book about these women in World War II. It's a great soundtrack, and I actually found it on CD a few years ago in the ABC shop. I was very excited. But there were some songs that I really liked that Mum listened to, but then I, you know, cycles of teenagers and you just move on to something else.
Yeah.
And then I don't know how I got into it. Maybe I was a Robbie Williams fan for a while, and he did a swing album.
Yeah, he did too.
But with great people in there, like Jane Horrocks, and he did this song with John Lovitz. And
he did a song with Nicole Kidman, didn't he?
Oh, I hate that song. And I hate that woman. It's just so irritating. But
he did a song with John Lovitz on that album?
Yeah, that's the song amazing. From High that. Society, another Cole Porter musical.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure it's the High Society song, the one that Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra sing together. I can't remember what it's called. So I guess this song is kind of... It's on the list because it's representative of my... I don't know if it's a love, but my interest in kind of swing music. But also old musicals as well. This song is probably in a musical, but I don't really know. But a Cole Porter. I love Cole Porter music, like High Society. And I think he wrote the songs for Kiss Me, Kate, and my mum watched a lot of MGM musicals when I was growing up.
Yeah.
So I saw a lot of those, and like Gene Kelly and all that sort of stuff. So this is kind of a little bit representative of that part of my life as well, I guess. So.
Oh, I didn't know you were all a big Cole Porter fan.
Yeah.
Keep that one hidden.
Not exactly like, they're not the, you know, deep and meaningful songs, but that period sort of between the wars and that post-World War II period when people needed, like, escapist stuff. Yeah. He writes great songs. And, well, I was torn, actually, between this song and there's a big band upbeat version of Night and Day that Frank Sinatra does. The slow version is boring.
Yeah.
And that's from a musical with Fred Astaire originally called The Gay Divorcee, I think. But the upbeat version is fantastic.
Yeah.
Do you know Night and Day?
No.
Basically, not. I think of you all the time. That's basically what the song is about. But it's really great. All these great, like this huge brass section, and it's very cool. So, I don't know. I just like this song. It's not particularly sophisticated, but
I think it's one of my favourite songs.
I like his voice better when he was younger.
Yeah.
There's kind of, maybe I'm attaching stuff to it, but. Yeah. When you learn about later on his associations with the mob and all this sort of stuff, and he wasn't a nice man from what I've heard. So maybe I attach that to his voice later on in life. But he just seemed in the movies like Anchors Away, and he looks so young and innocent and everything.
But he's a really good actor too. That's another annoying thing. Like,
At times.
At times.
I've seen some movies where he's well, not
Well, yeah. I mean,
fantastic.
It's the 50s, though. It's the 50s. You can see movies with anyone in them. And the director's probably going, no, more wooden. Be more wooden. But he was in The Manchurian Candidate.
I haven't seen
that. Oh, my God. He's amazing in it.
Didn't he win an award or an Academy?
Well, I think he won an award for The Man with the Golden Arm, where he was a heroin addict. But in... Like, they're just movies where you're like, oh, I forgot that was Frank Sinatra.
Yeah, he could actually act.
Yeah, because he's just... I mean, they're not... It doesn't have massive range, but very believable and very natural. But, yeah, like, I think the 50s weren't a good time for, you know, acting skills in that way. But, he's a complicated character.
Yes.
There is a big mythos behind him that I think was created rather than earned.
Yes, and there'd be, like, I've never read a biography as his, but there'd be so many out there. How do you know which one to pick? And I don't want to read hundreds of them and compare them or anything. Just to kind of know the nuts and bolts would be enough. You know.
I think that's all we can hope for with so
any
much.
Of them.
Yeah, it's just the nuts and bolts will do.
Yes.
Well, it's been a pleasure.
It has been
talking
a pleasure.
To you, as
you.
Always.
Thank you.
And that's it.
Good to chat.
I've got you under my skin. I've got you deep in the heart of me. So deep in my heart that you're really a part of me. I've got you under my skin. I tried so not to give in. I've said to myself, this affair, it never will go so well. But why should I try to resist when, baby, I know damn well that I've got you under my skin. I'd sacrifice anything, come what might, for the sake of having you near, in spite of a warning voice comes in the night and repeats in my ear. Don't you know, you fool, you never can win. Use your mentality, wake up to reality.